the word gallows occurs 8 times. But it's exactly the same word is as tree. He that is hanged upon a tree is cursed of God. And he bore our sins in his body on the tree. And obviously the gallows that was destined for Mordecai, we could say they were Christ's gallows, become the gallows of Haman. Just as the gallows intended for the crucifixion of Jesus really did do it, but at the same time, the old humanity was crucified with him. That is the kind of typology that clearly exists there, but it's a part of the whole flow of the literal story. So you could pick out, as I've done in my Bible, 8 places, you've got them there, just mark them in one colour and you can see the cross running right the way through to chapter 9, from chapter 2, is it chapter 3? You can see the cross running right the way through the book, chapter 2, verse 23. So there are some general observations. Now let's look at the text, obviously, very quickly. Well, there are 10 chapters there. It's true, chapter 10 is very small, but otherwise we need to look at the book as a whole now, as it line by line now. This wonderful banquet at which thousands and thousands of the officers and princes and the nobles and the provinces, governors came, and it lasted 180 days, and when the days were complete, the king gave a banquet lasting another 7 days for all the people who were present in Susa, the capital, from the greatest to the least in the court of the garden, the king's palace. And then it describes in terms again, which don't disagree with Herodotus, but seem to confirm what he says, and the drinking was free. You didn't have to drink. At some of these banquets you had to drink. Here it was just open for them to use. And verse 9, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So although it was usual in Persia, unlike some societies, for men and women to feast and banquet together, clearly, this was a kind of a hen night and the sort of little special do for the men and women in two separate places. I think generally men, and it's probably true of women too, I'm not sure, but don't behave as well when they're by themselves. I think men and women together are a much better mix, like it says at the beginning of the Bible, that it was, the authority was given to have dominion over the animals and to subdue the earth. He gave it to them. But it is much harder for men and women to work together, much harder than working or even here playing separately. And we've got to learn under the redeeming hand of God to return to paradisical conditions if we would see God's purposes ultimately fulfilled, I believe. So here are the women having their little do. Now on the 7th day when the heart of the king was merry, he commanded, and there's a bunch of his fellows there named, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. King became very angry, his wrath burned within him. The fragile male ego is upset at this point that at his command his wife doesn't appear. I don't know, of course it would probably was a lecherous and lustful kind of desire, but it needn't have been. It might have been dressed very fully and carefully and with a crown on her head. He might just wanted to say, what a great man I am, because look what a beautiful wife I've got. There are plenty of men that do that sort of thing. They use their wives for their own ego development, don't they? So it may have been just simply that. On the other hand, it could have been that he wanted to expose himself to some degree, but it doesn't actually say that. So I don't think that we can draw up the answer to the problems here simply on the grounds of immorality. I think we've got to think a little more deeply and perhaps get some more out of it. If you are going to humiliate your husband, Or if the husband is going to humiliate his wife publicly, okay, then it's about time we thought again and try to find a way to avoid it. She easily could have said the well-worn little phrase, "I've got a headache tonight, my dear," or something similar. And that would have given grounds not to lose face. But by just simply saying, "Oh, I'm not coming anyway," that was very humiliating. And most people blame King Ahasuerus. I would blame both. They're both at fault because they're both responsible people. And they should act in a way in which they would avoid public putting down. She could have torn him to shreds in the bedroom afterwards, but not publicly. Okay? So don't do it. If you want a decent marriage, you don't do that sort of thing. It's inevitable the marriage was going to fall apart. Well, there's all these other male chauvinists running around saying, "Oh, grief, what are we going to do now? All our wives will be up and putting us down and who knows what." Which really is a little bit pathetic in a way, but at the same time, it comes from a situation where maybe it should never have arisen in the first place. And you get this stupid legislation that all wives are to obey their husbands. After all, don't forget, you're not even dealing with some tin pot prime minister or president in modern society, even of America. You are dealing with the man in the Persian world who ruled from Greece to Burma to India, a massive great empire. You just don't turn around and say to him, you know, sucks to you kind of thing. You treat one another with respect publicly, even if you have a slightly more free relationship in private. Okay? Well, have you all learned that one? The Book of Esther's taught us something anyway. And so the relationship falls apart. And they say, let's legislate, let's get another queen, and the whole process begins. And it does fit again, once again, all that we know of this particular vast empire. In verse 17, the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands, saying, "King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought to his presence. She didn't come." They are the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard the queen's conduct was speaking the same way to all the king's princes. They're a fragile lot, aren't they? And there will be plenty of contempt and anger. "If it pleases the king, let the royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written by the laws of Persia and Media, so it cannot be repealed." Now that's an important statement. It's going to apply right the way through the book. When it comes to trying to repeal the order to kill all the Jews, he couldn't do it. Because the laws of the Medes and Persians cannot be repealed. It's an important fact to come in at that little point, so don't miss it. Keep your attention as you read the story. And then we've got this verse 20, where Yahweh is written in small print, as it were, hidden away in the text. "This word pleased the king and the princes, and even this kind of decision, God is working in all things according to the counsel of his will to get Queen Esther into position for the advance of his kingdom." She didn't realize it. Vashti didn't realize it. King Ahasuerus didn't realize it, but God is already at work. Letters were sent all around, and every man to be a master in his own house, and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. That's the way that it went out in every language. Chapter 2. After these things, the anger of King Ahasuerus subsided. He said, "Oh, I remember that little Vashti. She was a sweet little thing. Well, what am I going to do now?" Well, I'm afraid human beings act like that, and they, you know, cut off their nose to spite their face. Now he's getting a bit upset with himself. And the king's attendants said, "Well, we can go and find you another wife somewhere. We'll send people around. We get all the young virgins, bring them together, and you can choose who you like. And the lady who pleases the king will be queen in the place of Vashti." Well, the matter pleased the king. A simple chat, really, isn't it? Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives, who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. And he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. for she had neither father nor mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Came about when the command of the decree of the king were heard, many young ladies were gathered, and of course she gets gathered in as well. Now the young lady pleased him, and he found favor with him. Verse 9. Verse 10, Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed that she should not make them known. That was probably just a little bit of, you know, word to the wise when they get taken into the palace there. Don't make a song and a dance that you're a Jewess. You've got the name Esther, that'll cover it up. You don't have to use Hadassah. You can appear as though you're, you know, that's in a Greek sort of form of things. Either Esther was, as I say, it's related to Stella, or we would call it, or it's Ishtar, which would have been one of the goddesses. So outwardly there's nothing to say that she's a Jewess, so she keeps it quiet. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem. It's all about how he, obviously, he was a modern, and he tried them all out before he decided on one, like people do today, I'm afraid, sorry to say. But in actual fact, he eventually ends up with the right one as far as God's concerned. Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace, 10th month, month Tebeth, and in the 7th month of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all the women. She found favor and kindness. King gave a banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and servants, made a holiday in the provinces, gave gifts. Once again, they're all rejoicing and they're celebrating. Gifts are being passed around. At this time, it was possible, almost certain, that the king had lost a pretty big campaign against the Greeks, against a much smaller force of the Greeks. But it didn't upset him all that much. He's probably, you know, putting on feasts and so on all the time, and probably not himself too often going to war. He's blaming it onto his generals and the rest of it. At this time, there is an inscription that we found with the name Marduka. Now, is this an official title for an officer of the Susa Palace, or is it a reference to Mordecai? It's very hard to line up words in different languages, as you know. It transliterates, not always the same way you do it. But it does show that it is a possibility again. It's only a possibility that the Marduka word is when Mordecai had reached a high place in the Susa Palace, and this has been found there. So Mordecai was advanced at this stage because he'd heard of a plot against the king. And he told the king, and the king's life was preserved, and Mordecai at that time was not honored for it. Verse 23, the first time the gallows comes into view. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of Chronicles, the king's presence. A bit later on you've seen the book of the kings of the Medes and Persians. This man is a good historian, he gives his sources. I only make the point because people have so tried to tear to pieces ancient literature and or at least biblical literature. The fact is, he's writing up his story. So if you want to know more about this, you go to, you know, just like any modern scholar would do. He's giving his authentication as to why this is true or is not true, and he gives you his sources. Not a lot of early writers do that. After these events, chapter 3, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes with him. The king's servants, which were in the king's gate, bowed down and paid homage to Haman. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. As I say, his worship and his commitment was, "You shall have no other gods before me. The Lord is the one, him only shall you serve." Now it was when they had spoken daily to him and he wouldn't listen, they told Haman, see whether Mordecai, at first it would seem that Mordecai didn't notice. He would just march through and expect everybody to drop down, and people did, but Mordecai was still standing. And the other servants were the ones that actually tell Haman in the end, "Well, that Mordecai, he's a Jew, you know, he didn't bow down and worship," and then he notices him. So he gets very angry. So, again, you might say very petty, isn't it? Well, it is, but in the end, man's sin is always expresses itself in very petty, silly little ways. The arrogance and pride that needs that somebody should always bow down. Can you ever imagine Jesus acting in such a way, and yet he's worthy of all pomp and circumstance that anybody ought to give? But he would never act in such a way like that. And here's this man parading himself as though he was, well, not as though he was God. That's an insult to God. Because God doesn't do that sort of thing either. He's parading himself around as though he's worthy or demands that everybody should acknowledge his smallness in some great way. So they speak, and Haman sees, and he's filled with rage. Verse 5. The word for rage in Hebrew is hamah. So Haman was Hamah, Haman, Hamah. So it gives you the assonance that, you know, his anger is written into who he is. Well, I suppose that's the problem, really. He disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. That was not going to be good enough for him. He sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. You get the feel of that? One man's obedience, as he would see it, to God. Oh, come on, Mordecai. You could just acknowledge, you know, just bow down. It doesn't make any difference. We know you really worship Yahweh, but one man's disobedience and the whole nation's under threat. Don't like that, do we? One act of ours and all that suffering will ensue. Couldn't possibly do that. It's not very Christ-like, is it? That's the way the enemy would whisper to us. And that's the sad thing, in a way, where often decent people give in. It's the relationships. So you must love me more than father, mother, brother, sister, and so on. It's at that point we find it very difficult. It's not that those relationships aren't important. They're terribly important. They reflect our relationship with God. But if the push comes to the push, then we find ourselves in the place where, if you come after me, you must deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Any man wishes to gain the whole world. Yeah, he's a good fellow, Mordecai. I know he wouldn't bring us into any pain or disrepute or difficulty, but he did. And he did because he was obeying God. And that obedience to God is something he had to leave to God to work out because he didn't know how to do it. So the threat's coming on the whole nation. One man's obedience, the whole nation's destruction. In the first, and I mean, you know, we complain about it today, don't we? Oh, what on earth is Tony Blair going to let us into? Well, what's old Bush going to do? He's going to get us all into a mess. Well, Osama bin Laden, he's bringing all these Afghans into problems, and the Afghan world, we better fight because otherwise we've got nothing left. It is individual decisions that cause a terrific amount of pain across whole groups of people. Isn't it? We can't control it. Hence, how important it is that if we are, as we all will, make people suffer, that we do it in our obedience to God. And that he, therefore, can get something out of it. So, in the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of Ahasuerus, Pur, that is, the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day, month to month, till the 12th month, that is the month Adar. So they're playing the dice to find out which month. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people and the provinces. Their laws are different from those of all other people. It's the alien who is different from us that seems to provoke such dislike and hatred, which, God help us, we've got to get through and discover men and women in Jesus and not in their necessary culture. We don't like the way they cook or the way they smell or the way they dress. And the alien in our midst then is pilloried. I mean, there's nothing really more than that, is it? That you get these racial, ignorant people in racial riots. They are totally ignorant. They don't stop to think for 2 seconds. It's just, well, he's not like us, is he? That kind of thing. And it's very, very sad because, okay, I'm ancient, let's accept that and carry on from there. But that kind of attitude did not exist at the scale it exists today in this country. When we were an international body and we knew people all over the earth, yeah, okay, sometimes British people acted superiorly. But if people came to this country, we treated them, generally speaking, as decent people and expected to be treated back that way. Today we don't. We've got lager louts all over the place who have no thought whatsoever whether it's European or whether it's foreign, and it is the evidence of the demise of Christian values that we can treat people just because they're different in the way that some of the things have happened. Appalling that Afghan was left paralyzed simply because he was an Afghan. Can you understand such idiocy? But you can only on the grounds of the flesh, when you move back into the flesh and think that way instead of thinking, as I hope you are doing all the time, Christianly. So he wants to get rid of all these people because their laws are different from other people and they don't observe the king's laws. And it's not in the king's interest to let them remain. It's the easiest thing in the world, it appears, to stir up hatred against another group. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that if they be destroyed, I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry out the king's business, the king's treasury. Oh, you can put a bit of money in your treasury. But the king has got so much money, I mean, you can sing to him a few thousand more bits of silver. Oh, have it yourself, you know. Yeah, okay, carry on. I'm sure you've looked into this all right. Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Well, three here and eight correspond in many ways together. Verse 10, the king took his signet. In chapter 8, verse 2, the king took off his signet ring and gave it, this time, to Mordecai or Esther. Again, in verse 12, it's of chapter 3, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, etc., etc. Compare in verse 9 of chapter 8. The king's scribes were called at that time the third month, 23rd day, and they wrote to all the princes, and they wrote in all the different scripts according to their language, as well as the Jews according to their script, etc. Chapter 8, 3, verse 14, a copy of the edict was issued as law to every province. And in chapter 8, verse 13, a copy of the edict was issued to the law of every province. In verse 13, they destroy to kill and annihilate all the Jews. In verse 11, destroy to kill and annihilate the entire army of the people of the province which might attack them. When it says including children and women, I think that means a correct interpretation or translation would be that the women... that women and children are objects of attack, not that they were attacked by the Jews, but they were the women and children of the Jews. That's just like a parenthesis. Just say that in passing in case you have any problem morally with it. It's clearly the Jews who were male in the edict of chapter 8, 3, verse 13. It's the male. But then it goes on, both young and old, women and children. When the Jews protect themselves, it is only the males that they kill and not the women and children. Anyway, that's just a little bit of looking carefully at the Hebrew of the text. So there is a very clear parallel between 3 and 8, which confirms the kind of structure that I've laid out there. Virtually the same words are used in each of those verses I referred to. Chapter 4, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went to the midst of the city, wailed and bitterly, went out as far as the king's gate. No one was allowed to enter the king's gate in sackcloth, so he didn't go into the king's gate, but people were reporting, hey, that Mordecai is all over the place and he's fasting away and he's in sackcloth and ashes. So Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her. And the queen writhed in great anguish and sent garments to clothe Mordecai. Is it that you're running out of cash, my cousin? What's the matter that you can't come in? Haven't you got a decent suit of clothes so you can approach the king? So that was probably what was behind sending clothes to him, that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he didn't accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs, and the king appointed to attend her, and ordered to go to Mordecai and learn what it was. Mordecai tells him, says the king's treasuries, Haman has promised to pay the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Gave a copy of the text, of the edict. Hathach came back and Esther spoke to him and ordered him to reply, and the king's servants and all the people of the king's province know that for any man or woman who comes to the king in the inner court is not summoned, he has but one law. How can I go in? which is what Mordecai is wanting her to do, to implore the favor of the people. And they related Esther's words to Mordecai, that she can't go in. Mordecai was to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you're in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place." Again, is that a veiled reference to God? Another place means that God will raise up somebody else. So it's all beautifully hidden away, isn't it? But it's there, nonetheless. "And you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty, that you've come to the kingdom, that you've attained royalty for such a time as this. Think about why you've got there. How did you get there? Do you think God was not involved in it? If you've been living for him, of course he's there, involved in it." So Mordecai at this point reveals that he believes in God. He believes in God's guidance for individuals. And he believes that God is ordering world politics despite the rulers. It's all coming out just in those few words. "Go assemble all the Jews that are found in Susa," says Esther. "Fast for me. Don't eat or drink these 3 days a night." Now, my maidens will go fast the same way. "I'll go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." So, quite a lot of desperation. 3 days prayer. She still doesn't act, as it were, in panic, does she? Okay, I've got to go in. Give me 3 days. Fast for me for 3 days. Yes, that's 3 days nearer to the point which being found by rolling the dice as to what day they're going to be put to death. But nonetheless, I can delay that long. It's better to delay and pray than it is to panic and rush in. And she's waiting for the Lord's affirmation onto her life, a confidence rising within her. Yes, it's time to go in. 3 days later, she goes in and approaches the king, despite the fact that this was very, very clearly against the law. I read some description of how this palace, because they've reconstructed it from its ruins, that the king's sort of audience chamber ran alongside near where the harem was, and you could have come out and stood behind the pillars, as it were, and she probably did that, where he was in his throne room. And then, of course, people were escorted in and out, those who had got the favor to have a hearing with the king. But she came up, no doubt, from there and stood behind the pillar and waited for a moment to shoot out without being introduced and led in by the officials. So it was a dangerous thing to do. Especially since, as she said, she hadn't been into the king for 30 days. Maybe he was losing his interest in her. "Now it came about the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace around the king's rooms. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. It happened when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight." Do you think God was in that as well? "He extended to Esther the golden scepter, which was in his hand." The finding of favor is one of the ways God is at work in the world. People find favor. Christians find favor. We apply here and we find favor. God is at work through that. "And the king said, 'What's troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom may be given to you.'" They were extravagant, these guys, weren't they? He might have allowed Haman to slaughter all the Jews because a bit of money was coming his way and he didn't mind too much. Tiberius was a bit like that. The emperor, the days of Jesus. He had allowed a man called Sejanus, who was exactly in the same place as Haman is. Number one man in the empire, the prefect of Rome. And Sejanus was pretty well running the empire, while he sort of had opted out into a sort of an extended holiday. And then the emperor Tiberius married a Jewess, came back into the public to find that Sejanus, who hated the Jews, had put people like Pilate in charge in Israel, and he'd already murdered Jews. You know, dangerous business, these politics, isn't it? He's now going to be out of favor. And he found that Sejanus really had been usurping him, gets rid of him. Pilate is there in Jerusalem, very much under pressure. He's already shown terrible hatred for the Jews. killed them in their when they were doing sacrifices, you remember? He mingled the blood of the Galileans as they offered their sacrifices with their sacrifices. And was very high-handed with the Jews. Now, you're no friend of Caesar's if you let this man go. You see the punch in it? He's there already. Appointed by the wrong man, probably. You know, the emperor just putting his signature or anything. Now he's in the place where he's likely, if he shows any favor or any disfavor to the Jews, the Jews will be up in arms. They'll appeal to the new empress, and she will appeal to her husband, and Pilate will be for the chop. Well, he was a bit soon after that anyway. He wasn't a particularly good governor, was a weak man, but he was weakened even further by the historical circumstances. That's why you may find in some older books people questioning how could Pilate have changed so much that he wanted to favor Jesus, and then he would like to favor Jesus because he hated the Jews. But then he didn't go along and stand his ground, well, because he was already under pressure. You follow? So it had changed over the few years. That's another reason why I think AD 33 is a better date for the crucifixion rather than AD 30. It gives a bit more time for the new development to take place and for the change in Pilate to be observed. So, similar things happening here. He had enough sense, I was suggesting, that although he might have been a bit lazy and accepted the money that the Jews' pogroms would bring in, same reason that Hitler murdered the Jews was to get their money, ostensibly anyway. So, he says, oh yeah, okay, let's have a banquet. And he knew that Esther was after something. Obvious, really. Bring Haman quickly that we may do as Esther desires. So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Presumably in faith. She'd prepared it before she'd gone in and asked. So she's acting in faith. A little bit of faith teaching here. Step out in faith. And as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. What is your request, even to half the kingdom? So Esther doesn't immediately rush in. Clever woman. My petition and my request is, if I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king, grant me a petition that I request to have another banquet. It's building up the tension, isn't it? Haman is too thick to see it. Haman controlled himself, however. I mean, it's a lovely story. I mean, it's just like a music hall comedy, isn't it, in a sense. He's preparing the gallows and he gets hung on it himself. I mean, but, you know, that's life. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife, Zereth. And Haman recounted to him the glory of his riches, the number of his sons, every instance where the king had magnified him, how he had promoted him above all the princes and the servants of the king. And Haman also said, even Queen Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to a banquet which he had prepared. And tomorrow I'm invited by her with the king. I'm going again. Incredible. Isn't it wonderful? Yet of all this, it doesn't satisfy me every time I see that Mordecai, the Jew, sitting in the king's gate. King's gate, of course, doesn't mean just simply literally the king's gate. It's the place of where the council would meet. Mordecai was already high up in the kingdom, like Daniel became prime minister. Mordecai is well on the way up. He's obviously a hard-working, diligent man and has shown his loyalty to the king. He's been thus rewarded for it. And so Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends said to him, well, look, if it's going to make you feel a bit better, why don't you have a gallows 50 cubits high, which is big, 75 feet, but it's not as big as the image that Nebuchadnezzar set up of himself. It's not as high as that, but it was big. Have it set up 50 cubits and make it, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. The advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Second time the word tree is used. We would say the cross. During that night the king couldn't sleep. Here's the pivot of the whole story, pivot of the book. He gave order to bring the book of records and chronicles. They were read before the king. I suppose one of the best things to send you off to sleep is to read the official records. A government white paper generally does the same. So here he is listening and asks the question. It was found that when Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were at the doorkeepers and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. What honor and dignity is being bestowed on Mordecai for this? Then the king's servants who attended said, nothing's been done for him. So the king said, who's in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court. He was coming in to ask to hang Mordecai. I mean, it's wonderful, really, isn't it? If you were watching this, if it was on the stage, you'd all know. And he was supposed not to know. Whom the king would desire to... The king says, what shall be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? Haman said to himself, I suppose it's an example of egocentricity, which takes away all your discernment in the end. Whom would the king desire to honor more than me? Then Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let him bring a royal robe which the king has worn and the horse which the king has ridden. It goes on like this. This prestige is what he hungers after. On whose head a royal crown has been placed, let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor and lead him on horseback. Thus it shall be done to the man the king desires to honor. And the king says to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse, you've said, and do so for Mordecai, the Jew is sitting in the king's gate. And do not fall short in anything of what you've said. Well, say the Lord hasn't got a sense of humor. It's a slightly macabre, but... So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and had to lead him through the streets. This shall be done with the man whom the Lord honors. Mordecai returned to the king's gate. Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. Told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends, if Mordecai, before whom you've begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Interesting, isn't it? She's got a rough idea that it's a bit dangerous to start to play with the Jews. I think that has been true many times in history. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and they brought Haman to the banquet. He's still in a bit of a state. He's had to go through this humiliation. Now he's got to rush off to the banquet. You can't say that, this is faster than... And the McLean book, isn't it? The whole story is rushing to its climax. Now, the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther, the queen. The king said to Esther on the second day, also as they drank wine in the banquet, what is your petition, Queen Esther? I know you're after something. Now, what is it? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. Queen Esther answered, if I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. I want to live and my people to live. What? What's all this about? For we have been sold, you've been sold, and my people, to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. A clever one too, isn't it? Yeah. If you're just really sort of doing everything to us except murdering us, we'll put up with it because you're the king and I didn't want to annoy you, but this is a biggie, and if you don't mind. King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is it? Where is he? We presume to do this. Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and the queen. The king arose in anger, and from drinking wine he goes out into the palace garden. He's a bit, tipsy too, perhaps. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden into the palace with drink, Haman was fallen on the couch where Esther was, because they would lie on couches, you see, to eat. He'd gone over to her couch and was pleading with her, obviously, at her feet. But that, again, is pretty suggestive. And it really, the king gets beyond himself at this. Will he even assault the king with me in the house? With me in the house? And the word went out of the king's mouth, and they covered Haman's face. Yes, that's a rather quaint way of putting it, isn't it? They put a cushion over his face and stopped him breathing.
And Harbonah, one of the king's eunuchs, before the king's him. Oh, incidentally, your royal majesty, just out there there's a gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king, you remember. And the king said, oh yes, yes, we'll hang him on it. Pretty quick, rough justice in those days. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, fifth time the word tree appears, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's hand subsided. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. Mordecai came before the king, and Esther had disclosed what he was to her. And the king took off the signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And then she spoke to the king again, fell at his feet, wept and implored him to avert the scheme of Haman that Agagite. The king can't do that. He extended the golden scepter to Esther, but he can't change the law. He said, if it please the king, I found favor before him. The matter seems proper to the king and I'm pleasing in his sight. Let it be written to revoke letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are all in the king's provinces. How can I endure to see such calamity which shall befall my people? And how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? King Ahasuerus said, well, I've given the house of Haman to Esther, and they've hanged him on Haman on the gallows, and because he'd stretched out his hands against the Jews, conspired against the Jews. It's interesting in that it stretched out his hand against the Jews. God saved with an outstretched hand. The old man strung up on the cross, stretching out hands against God's ways. There's some beautiful allusions to the cross here. As he was hanged on the tree on the gallows. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit, in the king's name, and send it sealed with the seal of the king. In verse 11, in them the king granted the Jews who were to each and every city the right to assemble, get together, to defend their lives, to destroy, kill and annihilate. And then the entire army of any people of the province that might attack them. And then in brackets, including men and women, if they attack the men and the women, rather than saying they killed the children and women, and to plunder their spoil. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar, a copy of the edict was sent around to avenge or just punishment themselves of their enemies. And the couriers went out all round the place. So the day comes, chapter 9, and verse, already people are joining themselves to the people of Israel. Chapter 9, verse 1. 12th month, that's of Adar, on the 13th day when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, it was turned to the contrary. So the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities. They stood together, you see. They were allowed to assemble, not against any assembling, which it would have been if the local authorities had their way, as happened in church history. The assembling gives them strength throughout the provinces, and those who sought to lay hands on them, they couldn't stand before them, for the dread of them had fallen on the people. So the right to assembly, the standing together with the right to fight back, it wasn't a matter of killing people anywhere, any place. It was those who attacked them. Now they could defend themselves. Indeed, Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread through all the provinces. For the man Mordecai became greater and greater. Thus the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying. And they did what it pleased to those who hated them. And in Susa, the capital, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. And so it goes on. But they didn't lay hands on their plunder, verse 10. Verse 15, they didn't lay hands on the plunder. Verse 16, they didn't lay hands on the plunder. It seems just as Abraham would not aggrand himself, wouldn't take the money and so on, which came through defeating the five kings, you remember. Only enough money to pay for the food and so on of his young men. But he wouldn't assimilate it to himself. He didn't lay hands on their plunder. So perhaps Abraham at the beginning of the Jewish history gave an example which they are following at this stage. And there was feasting and rejoicing as they rested or were rid of their enemies, rested from their enemies. Verse 18. 2 days were set aside because there were 2 days which this attack took place on them. Therefore the Jews, the rural areas, who live in the rural towns, 14th day and so on, they had another day. Verse 20. They send portions to one another, verse 19 and 22. It's like Christmas, you see, they send little gifts across the board to different houses. And the common deliverances and the basis of their solidarity in sharing goods. The poverty was excluded by their having all things together. Feasting and rejoicing, this is anticipating the church age. Verse 23, the Jews undertook what they'd started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. They got rid, it looks a bit vengeful, but they got rid of the dynasty that might have attacked again. So the sons of Haman, who may have wanted vengeance, were also hanged. These days were called Purim after Pur. Now we went into that. This is the foundation of the Feast of Purim and how they found it through the throwing of dice. The Gentiles begin to align with them again, verse 22, those who allied themselves with them, that they shouldn't fail to celebrate these 2 days according to their regulation, according to the appointed time, annually. So every year, the Feast of Purim, they remember this terrific deliverance that God had given them. It was one in which they just didn't sit there and say, God is working all things according to the counsel of those who will, but Esther cooperated with God. And now the rest of the people of Israel cooperated with God in the defense of themselves. Queen Esther was given full authority in a second letter sent to all the Jews. And Mordecai and Esther are now in a place of security at the heart of government. And they were keeping these feasts, as it was written in the book, chapter 10, the outcome of the whole story. Now King Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land, on the coastlands of the sea, and all the accomplishments of his authority and strength, and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, and great amongst the Jews, and in favor with the multitude of his kinsmen. He was one who sought the good of his people, and one who spoke for the shalom, the welfare of his whole nation. I would suggest that the good of his people was the do good to all men, especially to the church of God. And the second statement, one who spoke of the welfare or shalom of his whole nation, was that he, having a Persian passport, counted the whole empire as his nation, and they sorted and lighted society as Jesus says the church of Christ is to do. And so we do it as we fast and as we feast, as we make sure we are rejoicing in the God who himself didn't just send the old man to the gallows, but had to take him there himself. And as Christ was crucified, the old man was put to death, the old humanity, and a new humanity, which others who are not Jews and not the people of God see and identify as, that's what I want to belong to. And wherever the old humanity is being crucified, there will be those who want the new and will flood in and will join the good of the people of God and will bring blessing and welfare to the nation that's round about them. That is the message of the book of Esther. Amen. I think that the example of feasting is such that you would always want to share. That's the whole point of feasting together, is that you're sharing. That people sometimes miss a feast, you get that in Nehemiah, and they sent portions to them. We don't want you to miss out on the joy and the blessing. So I think the idea of sharing is very much a festive thing, when we're eating together and we bring in those who haven't got anything, and none had any need, like it was in the early days of the early church, of the first century, first years. And we need to recover this kind of generosity of heart in the way that we express our lives and worship together. Generally, we don't. Generally, worship for the outsider. It looks as though we're collecting a lot of money in, but they don't see us giving it out. Hopefully, it's for the poor and for world evangelism. But nonetheless, this expression of sharing with one another is something which could well be released in the church, not just on Christmas, but, you know, is originally a pagan festival, but we've introduced the idea of gifts because of the wise men bringing gifts to the Lord by giving them to each other. That's the background to it. But all the year round, that feast represents the way that we're making sure there's nobody who is in need and that those who are without are getting their portion. Certainly the sharing bit is the important thing. If you're thinking in terms, you know, we give gifts and they come back to us and so on, that's not a bad interchange. Like the body does that, one cell pushes a bit of nourishment on, the other one pushes a bit back. So the body of Christ should express itself in that kind of way. And it could be a much more beautiful church life if we were thinking about how we can every now and again take people by surprise by what we share with them, or we give them this or give them honor or whatever. But I think on the picture of the Christmas that you're using, there was an outstanding experience in 1972 on the rubbish tip down in Juarez. And there they decided they would go out with their Christmas meal and give it to the poor who lived on the rubbish dump. And it was the beginning of a charismatic movement where people were being healed, lives were being transformed, people coming off drugs and so on. And I think, obviously, yes, if we were more concerned perhaps at serving the poor, which we must do because the Lord has commanded it, to remember the poor, and less concerned about, well, I'm going to give to this person because they're going to give to me, so I better, you know, kind of idea, then yes, we would be expressing the heart of Christ far better than sometimes we're doing at Christmas. I think that today we would be in as much trouble as the Jews, and probably we are. There are hundreds die each day for Christ. You realize that, do you? Never gets in the papers. Indonesia, Sudan, there are people dying. India, there are people dying for Christ. I think that it's important that we realize that when we are a part of the new humanity, or the vehicle through which God is bringing revelation to the world, that is Israel, come the church, that we are asking for trouble, you know, unfortunately. Because like Socrates said that if a perfect man came to this world, we would execute him, and then they executed Socrates. There is a sense in which if we were living the New Testament, that is the new humanity life of Jesus, as his body in this earth, we would find ourselves under a lot more attack and pressure than when we live compromised lives which take on the same values as the world. So yes, the Jews, I think, get it in the neck because they are the vehicle through which the seed in those days was being carried to the birth of Jesus. And then we who carry the life of Christ now should expect that, we don't want to wish it on ourselves, but that the life, the new humanity life, is not welcomed by those who want to do evil. So it will be attacked. It is interesting that the Jews have continued to be in that trouble. It may be because they are a kind of testimony to what God has done in bringing Christ into the world. And that is where the enemy's hatred is directed towards them. Well, you are dismissed.